Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahanau Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om. Very good. Welcome back. Welcome also to the many students who attend these classes online each week. We continue our study of chapter 14 of Uddhava Gita, which has various parts in it. The part we saw last week had Uddhava asking Sri Krishna how to deal with the suffering, the difficulties of life. And he has a very lovely way of expressing it. He says, it's like if you fall into a hole, that's pretty bad. But then inside the hole is a snake that bites you. So it goes from bad to worse. And he uses that as a metaphor for life. And certainly we all know how that feels, at least from time to time. It feels like you've fallen into a hole and been bitten by a snake. Sri Krishna's response is to say that, you know, your question about suffering, about how to come out of suffering, sounds exactly like the question asked by Yudhishthira he asked to Bhishma. At the after the Mahabharata war was over, and we'll set the stage for the question in just a few minutes. But Yudhishthira was also suffering at the end of the war. You'd think he just won the war. You'd think you'd be elated, right? Yudhishthira should be happy. Yudhishthira is now king. My gosh, he won the battle, he is now king, and he's deeply depressed, looking at all of his family members laying dead on the battlefield. We made this point in last week's class, and I'd like to make it again because it's such an important message, and that is, we think that when we get a certain accomplishment, when we reach a certain goal in life, then we've made it. And nothing could be further from the truth. Whatever you accomplish in life, whatever you gain, whatever goals you reach, you fulfill, you'll find that on the other side are more problems. How naive, and we've all made this mistake, how naive we are to think that when we cross a certain line in our life, we'll go from a life of struggling to a life of ease. Is there such a transition in life? You've heard me joke many times, there is a transition of life in life, but it's not at the beginning, it's not at the middle. Transition is here. When you cross this transition, death, you rest in peace. And that's the only time you can be guaranteed of truly resting in peace. So it's naive. So this is what Yudhishthira discovered, that becoming king and winning the war, that's not the goal of life. The goal of life then is found through these spiritual teachings. So this is what we'll see, starting with this next verse. Let's see the verse, and then I'll set the stage, so to speak, context. And this is Sri Krishna addressing Uddhava. Sri Krishna says, Tanaham te bidhasyami, Tanaham te bidhasyami, Devavrata, Deva Vrata Mukachutan, Deva Vrata Mukachutan, Jnana Vairagya Vignana,
Jnana Vairagya Vijnana Shraddha Bhaktyupa Brahmhitan Shraddha Bhaktyupa Brahmhitan.
Aham, I, te, unto you, Uddhava, abhidhasyami, I will give what? Tan, those teachings. Which teachings? Deva vrata mukhat shutan, the teachings which were shutan, heard from the mukha, from the mouth of Devavrata. Many of you know that Devavrata was the original name of Bhishma, the name given by his parents. You might remember, name given by his mother, Ganga, gave them name Devavrata. Father was Shantanu. You remember the long mythological story. It's a historical story. I won't recount it, except to say that Bhishma now, in our current context, at the end of the war has been fought. Bhishma is now laying on the proverbial bed of nails. By the way, how ridiculous some depictions of that are, right? Where they show all these, the bed of nails, bed of arrows. What is going on here? This is what's going on. Anyway, so how ridiculous are some of the pictorial depictions of this? They show all the arrows and it's like a bed of nails. So all the tips of the arrows are pointing. Bed of arrows is a metaphor. He's shot through with arrows which have not yet been removed. You can imagine if an arrow pierces from the front, it's going to be sticking out your back. He's laying on the ground with arrows sticking out of his back. That's his bed of arrows. This one looks a little comfortable. There are people who sleep on a bed of nails, I suppose, so all those arrow tips pointed up, that doesn't look so bad. There are no arrow tips pointed up. The arrow tips have pierced his body. He's about to die. And in this is with his dying breath, which goes on for quite a while. Remember, he has the boon of choosing the moment of his departure, so he stays alive. And in his last days, he gives this brilliant discourse to Yudhishthira. Yudhishthira asks, what can I do now? And as I said in the last class, that discourse is recorded in the Shanti Parva of the Mahabharata, the 12th book. And in that Shanti Parva, you first find the... What are the parts? I blank out. They are... back, front to back. There's the Moksha Dharma, Apadharma, and the Raja Dharma. That's one I didn't remember. I remember Moksha Dharma. Work backwards. So, Bhishma's instruction to Yudhishthira is first found in the portion called Raja Dharma, the teachings of how to rule the kingdom. Next comes Apadharma. These are huge. Each one is... thousand verses or more. Big. Mahabharata is huge. So then comes the Apat Dharma, how to handle this catastrophe at the terrible carnage caused by the war. And the final part, which is what we're going to be discussing here, is the Moksha Dharma Parva, the teachings on gaining moksha, freedom from suffering. And that's the third part of the message to Yudhishthira. Of course, his brothers are gathered near. Sri Krishna is standing there. Others are also gathered near to hear very attentively, to hear the words of Bhishma that he utters at the end of his life. And so he says, tan, shutan, those teachings, which are Deva Mukhat Shutan, those teachings heard from the mouth of Bhishma,
abhidhasyami. I will teach you. What about those teachings? They are jnana, vairagya, vijnana, shraddha, bhakti, upabrahmitan. They're upabrahmitan. They're filled with, full of jnana. Take the first three, jnana, vairagya, and vijnana. We've already used these words in this chapter. Jnana, we said, means knowledge, but in this context, we said it is paroksha jnana, scriptural knowledge, the knowledge we get from the Upanishads and all the scriptures that came later. And then, in fact, there's a sequence here. Jnana leads to vairagya, leads to vijnana. Look at this sequence. Jnana, knowledge of the scriptures, leads to vairagya. The scriptures, vairagya means dispassion. The teachings of the scripture lead you to understand the limitations of worldly life and the possibility of gaining moksha. Of course, you can understand the limitations of worldly life without studying scriptures. The school of life will teach all of us that lesson. But the scriptures very uniquely point a way to be freed from suffering, the way, the path to moksha is taught in the scripture, which leads to vairagya, dispassion. Naturally, you're already suffering so much in life. The scriptures point to a solution, and you'll be focused on gaining that solution. When you're focused on gaining the solution, you're less concerned about worldly matters. That is vairagya. And that vairagya, together with continued scriptural study, and especially through the practice of atma-vichara, self-inquiry. Self-inquiry is the main practice in Advaita Vedanta. So with that self-inquiry, atma-vichara, you eventually gain a paroksha jnanam. Here he uses the word vijnana. Jnana means knowledge, vijnana also means knowledge, but here in context, jnana means paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge, scriptural knowledge, which leads to vairagya, which leads finally to vijnana, a paroksha jnanam, immediate, direct knowledge, the personal discovery of your true nature as Satchit Ananda Atma. And these jnana, vairagya, and vijnana taught by Bhishma is also upabrahmitan, also accompanied by shraddha, faith, trust, and bhakti, devotion. So Bhishma, as the, odd to say this, he is probably the wisest character of all in the Mahabharata. And that's ironic, because the wisest character of all, for a variety of reasons, ends up forced to make terrible choices, leading to the war. The fact is, he's the wisest of them in terms of worldly wisdom. He was the wisest of them all. So I guess the take-home message from that observation is this: worldly wisdom, you know, you can be smart, but it's not enough to be smart. You can still have a terrible life because there are so many other factors acting upon you. So they say you shouldn't just work hard. In fact, they say instead of working hard, you should work smart. You've heard that expression. Working hard is good, working smart is good. It's just not enough, because no matter how hard you work, no matter how smart you are, no matter how good are your decisions that you make, we encounter obstacles in life born of karma, like Bhishma. In fact, just allow me just to share a little. This is Bhishma's problem. In spite of his wisdom, wisdom can't allow you to escape the karmas you're born with, right? And this story of Bhishma is perfect to show this, because the story goes back to the fact that these eight Vasus were born of Satyavati, prior generation. Eight deities were born of Satyavatis. They were, how does a deity get born into an earthly life? They were cursed. And I think we'll keep the story a little, you know, if we keep going, we'll get the whole Mahabharata. And because these are the opening stories of the Mahabharata. Anyway, these eight Vasus, they were celestial beings. They were cursed to be born as human beings. So we think it's pretty good, but if you are a heavenly being, to be born as a human being is a step down, so to speak. And these eight beings were then born to Ganga, goddess Ganga, who took I remember teaching this to children. Children were awed by this story. I said, goddess Ganga takes her first child, and her husband, Shantanu, is so happy. And then goddess Ganga takes her lovely little baby, newly born. She walks over to the river, and kerplunk. And the children are, what? That's the story. And then she gets a second son. Kerplunk. And third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, seven sons she takes and drowns her own newborn children in the river. Children are just amazed by this story. Of course, the back story, as it were, is Ganga was doing them a favor by freeing them of the curse of earthly life. They drown and they go back to heaven. Is the idea, so they're spared the suffering of earthly life, all except for the eighth one. Shantanu put down his foot, so to speak, and prevented Ganga, his wife, from drowning her eighth child, which means the eighth child was prevented from escaping the suffering of life. The eighth child bore the consequences of past karma and was doomed, as it were, to a life of suffering. Of course, you can still get out of a life of suffering with the help of this wisdom, but you can't get out of karma. Karma cannot be avoided. Suffering can be avoided. Can I say that one more time? You can't avoid karma, but you can avoid suffering. Bhishma had a miserable life dealing with all of this, but he was free from suffering, as we'll see, because of these powerful teachings. Bhishma gained moksha, and Bhishma is now about to impart those teachings of moksha. Of course, that eighth, I didn't say it explicitly, but that eighth child, of course, was Devavrata, was Bhishma, who was therefore destined to go through this life of suffering. So, before we leave this aside, I should mention that this Moksha Dharma Parva, which was taught by Bhishma to Yudhishthira and the others, we studied that here twice. First, we had a series of classes just on the Moksha Dharma Parva, and then years later, we had another series of classes on the Vedantic teachings of the Mahabharata. All of that is available as audio recordings on our website. If you're interested, go in and take a look at that. All right. Now that we know the context, let us see what are those teachings. This is not working, so you have to click on the PowerPoint. Maybe that'll bring it back. And if it doesn't bring it back, then you have to open up the PowerPoint on the bottom and click on the slides. Open up the PowerPoint on the bottom and click on the slides. The slide. Not the thin one, the fat one, the slide. Okay. This thing is a little complicated. Yeah. So this is the slide.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to click
on. So you click on that, and then it should work. Yeah. Okay. I hope it works. Yes. All right. Let's continue. Naivaikadashapanchatrin
Bhavan bhuteshu yena vai, Bhavan bhuteshu yena vai, Ikshatarthaikam apyeshu, Ikshatarthaikam apyeshu, Tadjnanam mama nishchitam, Tadjnanam mama nishchitam.
So these teachings were heard, Bhishma's teachings were heard by Krishna along with Yudhishthira and the others. And in the last line, Sri Krishna says, Tadjnanam mama nishchitam. That knowledge I have ascertained, nishchitam. And that jnana, remember how the word jnana was used in the prior verse? It was used in a sense of scriptural wisdom. So that scriptural wisdom was ascertained by me, and that what Sri Krishna is going to impart to Yudhishthira is all of these in the third and fourth lines. He's going to impart jnana, scriptural knowledge. He's going to show how vairagya, dispassion, is cultivated. He's going to show how vijnana, aparoksha jnanam, enlightenment, is achieved. And then in the next section, we're going to find a discussion about shraddha, faith, and bhakti. So all of this was imparted by Bhishma, and all of it is going to be imparted by Sri Krishna to Uddhava, starting with jnanam, scriptural wisdom. What is that scriptural wisdom? Go up to second line. We have to jump around a little bit. So in the second line, it is a knowledge yena, by which bhavan bhuteshu. It's the knowledge through which bhuteshu, in all beings, bhavan, the bhava, the existence of all beings, is understood. So first comes the knowledge of beings, the knowledge of that through which beings like you and me exist. And what is that knowledge? How cryptic. Look at the first line. That knowledge concerns nava, nine things, also ekadasha, 11 things, also pancha, five things, also treen, three things. How cryptic can you be? This is a common style in poetry, is you become intentionally cryptic, and that's also why we study these texts with commentaries. And here the main commentary on the Bhagavata Purana is by Sridhara Swami, and he explains very, not so complex. He says of the neva, the nine, in the teachings, and I don't want to get into a big complicated discussion of the teachings of Sankhya, which give 24 tattvas, 24 principles through which the universe comes into existence, universe including you and me. The first nine of those 24 are fundamental. The others are secondary. The first nine, and I'm not even going to enumerate, that's not our topic right now.
So the first nine of Sankhya's 24 principles, he mentions also Ekadasha, 11. That's a little easier to understand. Ekadasha is 5 plus 5 plus 1 in Vedanta. Otherwise, you can break it up any way you want. You have 5 karmendriyas, 5 organs of action, like grasping, walking, and talking. You have 5 jnana indriyas, jnanendriya, 5 organs of knowledge, including sight, hearing, etc. And you have 1 inner faculty called antakarana, or mind. 5 plus 5 plus 1 is 11. And then the last two are, you can figure these last ones out, pancha bhutas, and 5 elements, and 3 gunas. So all of this is Vedanta's pre-scientific analysis of the world, which is part of jnana, not part of vijnana. Scientific knowledge is knowledge of the world. Here, we're going to see a transition from jnana to vijnana. So what he learned from what Sri Krishna ascertained from Bhishma and what he's teaching now to Uddhava included all of this pre-scientific analysis of the world around us, but also, in the third line, atta, and also, ekam api eshu iksheta. Also, ekam api, the one, eshu, in all of these, the one which is iksheta, the one that can be seen in all of them, in all of that list above, in all beings and everything exists, there is one underlying reality because of which everything exists. We can call it Atma, or we can call it Brahman, and both are correct. Atma means self. Suppose this sounds funny. What is the self of this pot? That's one of the ways in which the word Atma is used. The self of this pot is clay, the underlying reality because of which this pot exists is clay. So the word Atma, which we usually use for consciousness, we can also use the word Atma as for this underlying reality. After all, isn't that what tattvamasi means? Tvam refers to Atma, and tat refers to Brahman. So the consciousness which is present in your experience right now happens to be the underlying reality because of which everything exists. And for this reason, Atma and Brahman are not synonyms, but they point to the same reality. Here we're talking about the underlying reality because of which everything exists, the knowledge of your true nature, the knowledge of the underlying reality. This is aparoksha jnanam. This is the direct, immediate discovery of the true nature of who you are as Satchidananda Atma, which is identical to that Brahman Tattvamasi. And this is what is going to be imparted now. Notice Sri Krishna very quickly shifts from jnana to vijnana. Jnana, allow me to make a little point here. Many, many students study Vedanta the way you study anything else. When you study a book on history, you learn all the important events that happened at certain points in time. If you study a book on anthropology, you're learning about what was the nature of mankind at a certain point of time. How did mankind evolve
from hunters and gatherers to those who lived in cities? How did all that process take place? So if you study books, you're gaining all that information. How many Vedanta students will study Vedanta in the same way? And as you've probably heard me say, to study Vedanta for the sake of extracting all the information in it is useless. Well, unless you happen to be in a PhD program in some university studying, gaining a degree in South Asian studies, maybe then it has value, but not for a sadhaka. So notice the distinction once again between jnana and vijnana, between paroksha jnanam, indirect spiritual knowledge, scriptural knowledge, the difference between that, and aparoksha jnanam, the term often used, atma sakshatkara, the sakshatkara, the immediate recognition of atma. And that's Sri Krishna switches gears very quickly and turns his attention to that higher knowledge, the aparoksha jnanam, and he says, etareva hi vijnanam, natataikena yena yata, stityutpatyupayan pashyet, bhavanan trigunatmanam. On that third line, I pause because I don't read phonetically. Many people read phonetically. I read words. And when you read words, you have to break apart stiti, utpatti, and apyaya. And you have to work a little harder to break the words. Easier to go phonetically. Okay, back up at the top. Etat hi vijnanam. This, indeed, is vijnanam, direct knowledge, aparoksha jnanam. What is that knowledge? It is a knowledge in the second line, tata, the knowledge, tata, of this sort. Of what sort? Yena ekena, the knowledge by which that one is known, the underlying reality is known. And this really distinguishes Vedanta from science. Some people use this word science. Some people will call Vedanta a spiritual science. And they call it so because it's very precise and logical. And they say, like science, it looks scientific. Parts of it may look scientific. But that term is really what we call an oxymoron. It doesn't make any sense. An oxymoron, by the way, the famous example was in the 1980s, I think, Ronald Reagan, president at that time, announced a new missile, a guided missile, a missile on which I believe it had seven or nine independently targetable nuclear warheads on one missile. One missile with seven or nine warheads which could actually be targeted to different cities, and Reagan called this missile the Peacekeeper. That is an oxymoron. What is it? The mother of all oxymorons. How's that? Anyway, so here, Vedantic science is an oxymoron because science is an analysis of the world. We don't care. I mean, science is important. We care in that sense. Science has given us long lives. If it weren't for science, almost none of us would be alive today.
life expectancy several thousand years ago was in the 40s, 30s maybe. So, science. Excuse me. Okay. Just give me a moment. Usually doesn't have, you know that I have a problem with this chronic dizziness. There are several pathologies which give rise to it, and usually it's not a problem, except sometimes when I'm moving around, it's a problem. Rarely do I get a spinning sensation while I'm sitting. Just wait a moment, it'll go away, and we'll continue. And it's not a big deal. You know, it's just, I joked the other day that when feeling a little, sometimes it's kind of nice. I give the, you know, you just. I gave the example of sleeping on a train, overnight trains. I love that. When I traveled in India, being on a, I never slept better. It's like mommy is rocking you in your in your cradle. It's really nice. Anyway. Okay. Let's pick up the thread here. Difference between science and Vedanta. So science is crucial for quality of life. But as we said, no matter how good your life gets, even if you become king, like Yudhishthira, doesn't make all your problems go away. Suffering is still possible, so Vedanta doesn't focus on science at all, but focuses instead on that one underlying reality. And so focusing on yena ekena, that one which is present in all things, and therefore necessarily na pashyet, enlightenment, na pashyet, does not focus on what? Stiti, the main, take other orders. Start with utpatti, break apart the words, stiti, utpatti, and apyaya. So utpatti, arising, birth, stiti, maintenance, continuance, and apyaya, death, destruction, loss. So enlightenment is na pashyet, is not concerned with the creation, sustenance, and destruction, bhavanam, of all things which are trigunatmakan, which are made of three gunas. So this verse makes it very clear how Vedanta and science are on two completely different perspectives. Science looks out into the world, analyzes the world, and helps us learn how to manipulate the world in positive ways, in ways that help us. Actually, that's not entirely true, right? We manipulate the world in some not so positive ways as well, resulting in global warming and climate change. Most of the ways that we manipulate the world are helpful, as I said, to our longevity, etc. That is not the orientation of Vedanta. The orientation of Vedanta is within. Just to introduce the next verse, this idea of the one because of which the many exist. And that's our discussion here. The one, this verse and a prior verse, what is the one because of which the 11 exist, the 9, the 5, the 3, the one because of which they all exist, the one because of which the three gunas exist, the one because of which creation, sustenance, and destruction exist, that
one. In Vedanta, we often give this metaphor of the clay because of which many pots exist. But it might be helpful to shift to a more modern metaphor. If the rishis lived in modern times, they would have a lot of new material to make metaphors. So back in the time of the rishis, they had clay pots. They used them as metaphors. They didn't have things like automobiles and computers. Had there been automobiles and computers, they would have used them as a basis for metaphors. One thing they would absolutely have used as a metaphor are movies. When you go into a movie theater, and I understand fewer and fewer people watch movies nowadays because we can see everything at home, but we've all been to movies. When you go into that movie theater, you watch all of these great films. I hope you're watching great films. There are many. There are many that aren't so great. So when you watch a film, there's a beginning of the film, there's a middle of the film, and there's an end of the film. That's what he says in the third line, right? There is utpatti, sthiti, and apyaya. And in that beginning, middle, and end, you get someone's whole life. In the beginning, they show about some person. They show the person as a child with the family. Then in the middle of the film, they show the person getting married, raising families, and having all these problems. If it's a typical Bollywood movie, they'll show the hero and heroine becoming separated. And then towards the end of the movie, they get reunited. And that brings to the end of the movie. So this is a typical, and in between they run around a tree. Sorry, I'm being very sarcastic about these movies anyway. But that movie represents your life, right? There's a beginning, there's a middle. Right now it's in the middle of the movie. And there will be an end to this movie, the movie which is our life, beginning, middle, end. And the reason this movie theater is so powerful is because whatever you see on the screen is nothing but light. One light becomes many on the movie screen. The rishis would absolutely have gone for this metaphor. One light becomes many on the movie screen. One reality becomes many in our lives. So look at how complex that movie is, beginning, middle, and end. Look at how complex your life is. Beginning, middle, and eventual end. But behind all of this complexity, behind the complexity in a movie theater, there is one light. Behind the complexity in our lives, there is one underlying reality, one truth, which is what Sri Krishna describes in the next verse. We'll see this one more verse.
Adavante cha madhye cha, Adavante cha madhye cha, Srijyat srijyam yadanvitat, Srijyat srijyam yadanvitat, Punastat pratisankrame, Punastat pratisankrame, Yachishyena tadevasata, Yachishyena tadevasata. Adau ante madhye cha. Adau at the beginning of the movie, at the beginning of your life. Madhye in the middle of the movie, in the middle of your life. Ante at the end. And also srijyat srijyam with regard to one thing born of another.
So suppose you're watching on a movie, you're watching a mother or a husband and wife, they have children. One thing born of another in the movie, one thing born of another in your life. All of this, yad anvitat srijat, that which anvita, all, literally it means always present, that which persists. That which persists, punaha tat prati sankrame. After one thing after another, prati sankrame means evolves and goes away. The characters, so many characters in a movie, they're introduced and then they disappear. Introduced, then they disappear. The hero and heroine get together, then they're apart. That's prati sankrama. All of these changes take place, beginning, middle, and end, but there's something which is anvita, persistent. What is persistent in the movie is light. What is persistent in the movie of your life, if we can call it that, is you, the truth of who you are as Satchidananda Atma. And that's what he says in the last line. Tat-shishyena, yat-shishyeta, that which remains. When the movie is over, the projector is still there. The bulb in the projector is still there. And the next movie will come. What is that a metaphor for? The next movie is your next life, your next birth. The rishis would have loved this metaphor. The projector can show one movie after another movie after another movie, and you can be reborn again and again and again. But there is something which is anvita, something which persists. And here the metaphor breaks down a little bit. Every metaphor is not perfect. So set the metaphor aside and come to what persists in your life. Think about when you were an infant, this big, and who you are today. What has persisted? Not much. Not much similarity between that little infant and who you are today, but one thing that has absolutely persisted without change is the truth of who you are, consciousness. The consciousness by which you knew mom. Babies go for mom. The consciousness that allowed you as an infant to grab onto mom. That consciousness is the same as the consciousness present right now in your experience. That consciousness is the truth of who you are. That one is persistent in the beginning, middle, and end of your life, which means persistent even from life to life, because the next movie will come and the next movie will come. But what's more important here? What's more important is, in order for consciousness to persist, it must be unchanging. Let me make this point and show why it's so important. Think of how much your body has changed. If you look at a baby photo, do you even recognize yourself? When you're newborn, by the time you're a couple of years old, you can see your features. But in that newborn baby, you don't see any resemblance. I don't, at least when I look at a picture of me as I just see this. I don't. I won't describe it. It's just this lump of flesh. I don't know. You can tell I was never a parent. I don't think ever any parent would refer to an infant as a lump of flesh, but not having raised children, that's what I looked like to me, lump of flesh. I don't see any semblance at all. But what? The body has undergone so much change. Suppose consciousness underwent so much change. You wouldn't be the same person today that you were yesterday. Even in one day, we undergo so many experiences that change us. Little experiences change us a little. Huge experiences lead to huge changes in our minds. Suppose, just as your body changed from day to day, by the way, for little children, you can almost get the sense of their growth, maybe not day to day, but certainly month to month, year to year. If your consciousness changed like your body did, you would be a completely different person every couple of months. And then somebody, it might be helpful, your boss said, last month you made this mistake. You say, that's okay, I was a different person then. Could be a good excuse, but that's not the reality. We're not this different person from who we were a month ago, a year ago, a decade ago, many decades ago. Bodies are different. Minds are different, personality even, to some extent, different. That what is anvita, the thread of continuity, is in consciousness. Now, this sounds, at this level, it's an important philosophical truth. The important philosophical truth is your consciousness is unchanging, is an important philosophical truth. But how many times have we discussed how philosophical truths are not what we're interested in? What we're interested in is freedom from suffering, not philosophical truths. So how does this philosophical truth about consciousness not changing, how does that help us become free from suffering? And this is one of the most important teachings of Vedanta. Suppose you can discover that your consciousness, the consciousness present in your experience, is absolutely unchanging. Unchanging not just year to year and day to day, unchanging moment to moment. Suppose you can discover that. I am unchanging consciousness. That is the aparoksha jnanam, direct knowledge. That is the knowledge of enlightenment. I am unchanging consciousness. When you discover that, then if somebody says, you're an idiot, many people get offended by that. Does unchanging consciousness get offended? To get offended means what? It means to be hurt, to feel denigrated, to be put down. All of that is emotional reaction. Emotional reactions which may or may not take place in your mind. Those reactions will take place in your mind if a peer or someone superior to you says you're an idiot. But if someone who is less than you, like a child, says you're a dummy, you don't take it seriously. So the point is, when somebody says you're an idiot or a dummy, you may or may not have an emotional reaction, but Atma doesn't have emotional reactions because Atma doesn't change. Consciousness doesn't change. You are the unchanging witness of all this changing activity in your mind. Suppose you shift your identification from their body and mind, and you have that realization of enlightenment, I am unchanging consciousness. This person says, idiot, who cares? I am unchanging consciousness. Can you see how that frees you from suffering? By shifting your perspective. By shifting your perspective away from the body and mind, shifting your perspective towards your true nature as unchanging consciousness. This movie metaphor shows it so nicely. We'll just make a slight change to the metaphor. And instead of talking about the projector, let's talk about you watching the movie. And you're sitting in the theater, you're watching the movie, and all this stuff, and you're getting really worked up. And then the hero and heroine are separated, and then the hero finds out where the heroine is, and then the hero finds out the heroine is incorrectly told that she died. She didn't, but that's what he thinks. And you're sitting in the theater and you're crying because I've watched some of these old Hindi movies, not for a long time, but I remember watching some of these. I cried. My gosh, there he is. What is this one? Kabhi Sukhi, Kabhi Gum. Oh! I cried! I'm not kidding. Man, they manipulate your emotions brilliantly. Excellent, and people love that. I don't know. Anyway, it's nothing wrong. If you love that, you love that. Here's my point. You're crying. You're in that theater crying. And then the movie's up, and you get up and walk out, and you're fine. While you're watching the movie, you are drawn in to the drama. There's a nice American expression, idiom, sucked in. You get sucked in. And you lose perspective. You forget that you're even in a theater. You get sucked in. And that's why you're crying like that. But then, movie comes to an end. You are now asakta. Does that work? With the American idiom, you can be sucked in, or you can be asakta, detached. What a weird pun. A pun in which one word is English and one word is Sanskrit. You can be sucked in or you can be asakta. Asakta means detached. The opposite of sucked in is asakta, detached. You become detached. And when you become detached, tears are gone, sadness is gone, suffering is gone. This is what the teachings of Vedanta give you. Not merely the philosophical truth that you are unchanging consciousness, in essence, but more than that, the realization that as unchanging consciousness, you remain utterly untouched, unaffected by everything that happens in life. You are okay no matter what. No matter how sad the movie is, you walk out fine. No matter how troubled your life is, inside, as Satchidananda Atma, as a true self, unchanging consciousness, you are okay no matter what. So you see the point. It's not merely philosophical knowledge we're after here. We're after a shift of perspective that frees us from suffering, and that is what these teachings of Vedanta are about. So tat tat shishyeta, that which remains, tadeva sat. That indeed is the reality, the unchanging reality, which is your essence, that one because of which the many exist. And that's a good place to conclude today. An important announcement, we usually have our classes on Sunday, the Vedanta class and the satsang. Tomorrow there will be no classes, no programs. Arshavidya Gurukulam, our parent ashram, is celebrating its anniversary. I'll be joining them for that anniversary, so we won't have classes. You're all welcome to come to that anniversary celebration. Go to their website and you can get all the information and directions. And we'll conclude with our prayers. Om Ganana Hantva Ganapatigam Vamahe Kavingavinam Hupamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanaspatahana Shrenvan Uttabasira Sadhanam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Gurur Hatmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanura Mardanam Devaki Paramhanandam Krishnam Vande Jagad Gurum Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Satkamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritangamaya Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Om Tat Sat.